The Mixtape with Scott. I am your host, Scott Cunningham. I'm a professor at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. And this week, I have the honor of having Peter Behtke, the distinguished university professor of economics at George Mason University and the director of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. I've been a longtime admirer of Pete for actually before I even started graduate school. I had found some things that he had written when I was just sort of in between graduating college and starting my PhD. And since then, I've sort of watched Peter and how he is towards others and how he is as both a scholar as well as a mentor from a distance, and have been really inspired by the kind of person he is. Very positive person, very optimistic person, extremely friendly, extremely caring, scholarly, and cares a lot about his students being a mentor. Peter's part of a series, I guess, that I'm doing. I guess I don't know if it's true I'm doing a series on Austrian economics, but I'm trying to talk to people that sort of belong to all parts of the distribution of the economics profession over the last 50 years, because the Mixtape with Scott is first and foremost a podcast devoted to listening to the stories of living economists, but it's secondarily an oral history of economics over the last 50 years by interviewing people. And Peter sort of fits within the profession for a lot of reasons, for his background in public choice, his background in Austrian economics and institutional economics, but also by being connected with George Mason University. And George Mason University is a special department that became sort of home over many different moments to many different parts of economics, both public choice, where James Buchanan won his Nobel Prize. Vernon Smith was a faculty member there and won his Nobel Prize when he was there. Austrian economics, law and economics, and these days is very stacked with a lot of economic historians. So it's a pleasure to meet Pete. Every time I see him, I have such a nice time, and I hope you enjoy this interview with him as much as I did. Thanks so much for tuning in. Well, it is my pleasure to have someone who I think we have met in person, Peter, but we've not really had an extended conversation before, a little bit. Peter Behtke, thank you so much for being on the show, Peter.
Thanks, Scott. It's great to be here, and I'm thrilled to have this conversation with you.
Well, for the sake of the listener, would you tell us your full title and the name of the firm that pays your salary?
Yeah, I am a distinguished university professor at George Mason University, and I am a director of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University.
Awesome. Awesome. I can't wait to get into all this. Well, let's start with an icebreaker. What's a vacation that you went on as a young person? Not necessarily, it could be your favorite vacation. It doesn't have to be, but you, to this day, you've thought about it at least a couple of times.
Oh, it's a great question, actually. I'll give you two. The first one is my honeymoon my wife. We went to Disney World down in Florida, and we stayed at the Polynesian Hotel because we couldn't afford to go to Hawaii. And so this was our effort to try to have, a Hawaiian honeymoon. And we went to the Polynesian. And many years later, my wife and I returned to Disney World and did the same kind of thing. And, we're there without the kids. I mean, we went several times with the kids, but we went again without the kids. And it just always brings back tremendous joy and memories for me and everything like that. And similarly, I was, you can't tell by looking at me now, but I was a college athlete. I played basketball and tennis, and I ended up focusing primarily on tennis. And my tennis team in college, every spring, would leave from Grove City, Pennsylvania, and drive down to Jekyll Island, Georgia, where we would stay in these cabins and then go play places like Jacksonville State, Savannah State, places like that, that we would play them, and then we'd head back home. And I went there every spring, you know, when I was in college, and, you know, the nearest person to us was 80 years old. and you know, it was like, you know, our coach loved it that way because he could go play golf and we would have to have, you know, so many workouts and then play our matches. And he loved it because he didn't have to worry about us going to bars or anything like that. And I hadn't been there for like ever. And just 2 years ago, I had an opportunity to go back to Jekyll Island for a Liberty Fund conference. And I brought my wife with me to show her, you know, and we actually drove over to where they used to have the cabins. I showed her where the tennis center was and all those things like that. And we stayed an extra day or two and then, you know, went out on a cruise out on the water there to see, you know, the different things. And we just had a great, you know, it was just a really great time returning to the scene of this kind of Spartan existence that my tennis coach forced us to go through. And now we were staying at the nice resort. Why did he put us at the resort?
Did that bring up back a lot of memories going with your wife?
Oh yeah, it was fantastic.
Yeah.
Because she never, you know, she went home for the spring break and I was always heading down there. Even the year before we got married, we graduated May of 1983 and got married in June of 1983. So we went right from graduation to getting married. But in preparation for the weddings, it all fell on her because I was off playing tennis, you know, and was not involved. So I didn't go home at the spring break when they were doing all the final preparations, everything. I was like, oh yeah, you know, so yeah, it's great. But yeah, pretty much all the vacations and things that I remember so fondly and enjoy, they're very much tied to my life with my wife. We started dating, Rosemary and I started dating when we were in high school. And
so
I have a very, you know, we've been through all this thick and thin, and we're now grandparents, which is like
wonderful. The
greatest deal in the world. Yeah.
Oh, that's a wonderful. Well, I'm so happy for you.
I can't wait to take my grandchildren to Disney World.
To Disney World. Then take them to Jekyll Island. Say, my granddad played tennis.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So tell me, where did you grow up and what did your parents do for a living?
So I grew up in New Jersey Union County. My wife grew up in Ocean County. My grandparents lived down in the beach, and that's how we met in high school when I would stay with my grandparents in the summer. But I grew up in a town called Clark, New Jersey, which is bordered by Rahway and Linden. It's right outside of York, New Jersey. And so I was a kind of a densely populated, it was suburban, but today we would refer to it, you know, kind of at least when I did it as a middle to lower middle class, working class kind of town. It had a very strong ethnic neighborhoods in which they were divided. So, you know, there was like two Catholic churches that right around, which is one was for the Polish, you know, people that went to the Catholic church on that side of the town. The other one was for the Irish Catholics that went on the other side of the town. We had, you know, four elementary schools feed into two middle schools into one high school. And so, you know, we all you know, did that. And I had an amazingly wonderful childhood because I had you know, parents that supportive and loved me, and I had two siblings, my brother Fred, who unfortunately is no longer with us, but my sister Sue. They just created a great environment, and I loved it. I got inducted into my high school Hall of Fame a couple of years ago, and my sister lives in Portland now, my wife and my brother and I went up there, and again, you know, Rosemary and I hadn't been there since the late 1970s, I think probably maybe 1980 would certainly have been the last time I was there. And, you know, I drove and You'll get a kick out of this. When I was a kid, there was a hill down at the end of the road to my house. And we used to go sledding there in the winter. And we all called it Suicide Hill because we thought it was this huge hill. When we drove by it, when we went back, I found out it was like, the smallest little hill in the world. And like, so my memory of that was shocking. So yeah, I mean, just I do I had a very idyllic 1960s, 1970s childhood. Yeah.
It sounds wonderful. It
My
sounds
mom, by the way, was a nurse, and my dad was involved in construction. So they their education was World War II, right? That's where they got educated. And so they put a big stress on all of us going to college. That was not, what their path was, but they were dedicated to having their kids do that. And so I can't remember a time in my life where it wasn't stressed to me that I was expected to graduate high school and go to college, though a large number of my classmates didn't, that was not the path they were on.
Did y'all ever go into the city when you were little? Just in New
Oh
York City
yeah.
all the
But
time?
for all the time. In fact, a funny story of that is that my wife was taking Spanish in high school, and they had to do directions to go to New York City in Spanish. And I said to her, I said, "Oh, I know how to do that." And I gave her directions, but the directions were to the train station to take the train in, because that's the only way I knew how to go into the city. Was, you go through this road and all these elaborate side turns to get to the little train station. And she was like, "You're an idiot," like that. But yeah, no, I used to go, and especially with my dad, I went into the city a lot for sports. And so I went in there to see the Knicks play during their heyday. And I can remember the first time walking into Yankee Stadium as if I was walking into, the most amazing cathedral of the world. It was I was a kid, and I walked into a professional baseball stadium. You see the way that they keep all that stuff and everything like that. It's amazing.
Do you pick that up from your dad? Was he very athletic also?
Yes, yeah. And my whole family was, that was a kind of a thing that just, was a big part of it. My dad was an outstanding athlete, and my brother and my sister all had, they, I'm the youngest, and they all had great athletic careers. Yeah.
Was tennis and basketball the modal
So
sports?
I
Was it
was,
other
yeah.
stuff?
So my dad was a great tennis player and high school basketball player. And given that you're at ba Butler, Baylor, let me tell you something. My dad, when he first joined the Army Air Corps, he was stationed in Waco, Texas. What he did was he played basketball for 2 years at the beginning of the war for the United States Army Air Corps team, which traveled around to raise money for the war effort. And eventually my dad left and wanted to fly in Europe. And so from 41 to 42, basically he was playing basketball, but in 42 he was then trained and then shipped over to Europe, and then was on the bombers, that went from England into Germany. And then his crew flew 29 missions, and then they were shot down on the 30th, and he was in prisoner of war camp. And he was part of that group that did the forced march, across, Eastern Germany to Western Germany, and then was
Oh gosh.
liberated, after the war in the winter of 44, I guess, right? He was shot down in November of 44 and was liberated in May of 45. Yeah.
Oh gosh. Wow.
And most of the dads like that I grew up with, all of our coaches were military people, right? Everyone had been in World War II and had done that. That was the, my town, besides if you didn't go the academic route, there was a lot of military people. There was a lot of obviously union people, pipe fitters and welders and stuff, but then also people that went into police and to fire department and things like that. So it was these were all the people that I was around as a kid learning to play baseball with and everything like that. Personally, myself, my brother was a very good basketball player as well. So I grew up you know, around basketball. But when I was real little, I was obsessed with baseball. Mm. And you'll appreciate this. I was also somebody, which is unlike the other people around me, I was obsessed with statistics.
Uh-huh.
And so I used to, they used to have a baseball almanac that they would sell at the, you know, and so even when I was like 8, 9, 10 years old, I would study that thing and I would ask people questions like, did you know what, you know, Babe Ruth hit in this year or whatever? And I knew all those stats. I was obsessed with them.
Yeah.
And so I was obsessed with baseball as a kid until 1972. And in 1972, what happened was the U.S. team lost in a very controversial Olympic basketball game to the Soviet Union.
Oh.
And I became obsessed with basketball after that. I kept playing baseball. I played baseball all the way through high school and into American Legion. But basketball became my main focus. I was, you know, even I played football in high school. I would get in trouble because I'd come back from practices and want to shoot, you know, baskets or whatever. I just loved, you know, the game of basketball, and I still do.
But the baseball,
I was very excited to see your coach decide to stay.
Rather than head off
to Kentucky.
To Kentucky, we were very excited. Yeah, he'd have been hard to replace. So, what kind of student when you were in high school? What kind of student, if I could have like eavesdropped on your teachers in the teachers' lounge, what would I have heard them say about you?
So I was not a very good student. I was because what my primary focus was on sports, basically, and that's all I cared about. And all I knew was that I needed to get a C average to be able to compete. And so, you know, getting a C or a B average is all I, you know, cared about. And I knew I had to score a certain amount on SAT scores in order to qualify if I wanted to try to play at the next level or whatever.
Yeah.
It's weird that I had that because at the same time, I must have done some kind of things on standardized tests and whatever that I got put in like AP biology and, you know, these other kind of things. I was in AP physics. Geometry. I also was in an advanced class. And in fact, the teacher in that class would have me sometimes go up and do the proofs, you know, even that's when you're a sophomore in high school when you're taking geometry at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I had an AP history teacher pull me aside in my junior year and ask me, what are you doing? And I said, what do you mean? He says, why are you wasting all your talent? He says, you go out there, you're trying to do all these things with sports. You should be doing this stuff in school. And I remember thinking at the time, like, what's your problem, buddy? Why are you telling me this? But this became very important. And he told me a couple other things. He talked to me about, you know, my IQ and all the kind of things like that, which I never, you know, I didn't even like really care about. But what happened was when I decided that I needed to catch up as an academic, because college in a lot of ways was similar to the way I was in high school. I was focused on other things other than, you know, school until I decided that school was the thing I needed to focus on because that's where I had to go with my career. I had a lot of faith that I could do it, right? Because I had this history professor back from my junior year telling me, you should be doing this rather than this. And so when I decided to do this, I said, oh, well, he told me I could do that, so I can do it. And I always tell my graduate students that the most important words they're ever going to learn is I don't know, or I do not know, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, but the second most important words are, I'll figure it out, right? So I don't know, but I'll figure it out. Like, and I'll have fun in the figuring it out. And I think that figuring it out is confidence that you have to have. That you can figure it out. If I would say, I don't know, and there's no way that I could figure it out, I'd shrug my shoulders and I'd stop doing it. But it's because this, so I had great teachers in high school that even despite that I was not the kind of student that I should have been, they still were there to say, you know, go do it, you know?
Yeah.
And so that was great. Yeah.
Oh, man. Those teachers make all the difference.
Yeah, my mom used to say when after, I went on and became a professor, she would chuckle sometimes. She said, "Oh, I never would have expected, Peter when he was growing up that he would end up doing this,
Yeah.
But yeah, so it was just but again, even with my parents, they were amazingly encouraging. My dad wanted me to have a degree in a practical issue,
Wow.
right? When I went to college, he thought you should have something, a practical thing, which is either engineering or something like accounting or something like that, right?
Yeah.
And here I am getting all excited about economics. And
In
I'm like, I really like
college.
economics. But
In college.
in college, that's when I got excited about economics.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, Dad, I read Milton Friedman's Free to Choose, and it in addition to a bunch of other things, but that was the catalyst book. And then
Huh.
I wanted to dig, I'll come back to that in a second. I really wanted to dig into two propositions that I got from that book, which really blew me away. But
Huh.
I'm writing, I in fact I saw a letter that I wrote to my dad recently, which was funny. I was still playing basketball at the time, and I write this long letter to my dad about my studies and about how everything's going, and all it is about economics. And then the very last paragraph is, oh yeah, basketball's still going, well, or something like that. Whereas, I would have thought that it would have been at that age reversed. It
Yeah.
would all be about basketball, and then, oh yeah, I found this class in economics. But
Yeah.
yet it wasn't. It totally sea changed my life. But
Yeah.
I also came home and told my dad that I wanted to study philosophy. So I was a double major in college, economics and philosophy. And my dad, I'm sure, must have been like, what the hell? Like, you're supposed to be a mechanical engineer or an accountant or something that's valuable. And here he
Right.
is, wanting to do this. So yeah. Anyway.
Have people told you before, you're a passionate person, that you're like, you go all in, and you're, when you become interested in something, you just become super into it? Is that, people said that? 'Cause you could interpret this like you're in love with sports, and then you just get in love with economics. And I was wondering if that's a trait.
No, I mean, I do think that that was probably obvious at a very early age for me, is that I had this obsessive kind of
Yeah.
attraction to certain things, and that's in retrospect. I was I played sports in the period before there was hyper specialization, right? So I played, but my passion was one sport. But all my coaches wanted us to be what we are today, hyper specialized. So I
Right.
remember when I was playing football, the football coach is like, making fun of me for wanting to play basketball, get better at basketball. And I remember he said at one time, he said, well, rather than playing football next year, why don't you run cross country? Like, that was to like insult me, so that I would be more motivated to play football. But in fact, it made me less motivated because I really cared about playing, basketball. So, the coaches wanted us to be hyper specialized. But by the time I was in high school, all of my real passion was on hoops.
Yeah.
Rather than, but I really, really enjoyed playing baseball. Like, I love the practices of baseball, things like that. And it was
Yeah.
just.
Yeah. So you find where, so you're at Grove City College, and so how are you finding Milton Friedman's book? Is it you're in economics classes already, or is it you read the book and you were like, I want to go take economics classes?
No, so at Grove City, every student had to take Hans Senholz. So Senholz was, they either had to hear lectures of him in this general hall, or they had to take his class as a part of requirement. So Senholz, the Grove City College was founded by the Pugh family, J. Howard Pugh, Sun Oil, Sunoco. And J. Howard Pugh grew to be a very big industrialist, right?
Okay.
And Senholz was a student of Ludwig von Mises, the first PhD student
Oh.
of Mises in the United States.
At
And he was
NYU?
teaching at NYU, and then he taught
Oh.
at Iona College. But there was this little foundation group called the Foundation for Economic Education. And
Yeah.
J. Howard Pugh was involved with them. He was on their board. And Senholz used to give lectures at FEE. And so J. Howard Pugh saw him and said, I don't want you teaching at Iona. Why don't you come and be the department chairman at Grove City? And he taught at Grove City for 30 years. And so he was able to construct how the major was done and all these things like that. But he also had it that you had to, you know, just to get your general degree, you know, you sat in on an economics class. So I had to take an economics class. I was not interested in economics. I had no desire to be in economics. But the summer before I went to Grove City, I worked for a short bit digging pools.
And I did that too.
And part of the digging pools, this pool construction company, was that it was in the midst of the gas lines. Okay. Oh. And so I experienced the gas lines in a very visceral way, in a way that I wouldn't have had I not, especially since I was the youngest guy in the crew, and they sometimes siphon gas and they would make me do the siphoning, and, you know, I just hated it. And so I go to college and I'm sitting in the back row, you know, not paying attention, you know, I'm there to do something else other than be in this class.
Yeah.
But Senhal starts explaining why it is we have the gas shortages in the United States. And all of a sudden I'm like peeking up and looking at the guy, and I'm like, okay, you know, like that. And so that's the fall of 1979.
That's why y'all were siphoning the gas?
In the summer of 1979, but the fall is we've taken Senholt. And I'm sitting there in the fall of 1979, and all of a sudden someone explains to me why it is I just had the stuff happen to me that I did in the summer, right? And so I was like, oh, I got to pay attention to what this guy's telling me.
Yeah.
And if you look at that timing of that date, it's 1979. That's right when 1979, 1980, that's when Free to Choose is published. That's when Milton Friedman's on PBS, you know, and so the whole nine yards of watching that. So I'm reading other market-oriented works from Senholtz, but Free to Choose was the book that came out. I read it and I was blown away by the two chapters next to one another, which is The Power of the Market and The Tyranny of Controls. I have to say the other chapter that Friedman in that book that really excited me at the time and still does is Who Will Protect the Consumer, where Friedman runs a horse race between, say, government regulation or the self-enforcement of the market. So that relates to the increasing power of the market, because not only can the market allocate resources, it can actually serve as this self-governing mechanism against the things that everyone's telling you goes wrong in the world, right? And then on the other hand, you have the tyranny of controls, which is that government controls can't fix the problem. And then you have, in Friedman's book, his redoing of the basically public choice, what later I would come to know as public choice, and his discussion. I don't know if you how familiar you are with the book, but he has the invisible hand of the market, but then he also has an invisible hand mechanism in government, but he argues that it does the opposite of what Smith's invisible hand does in the market. So individuals pursuing their self-interest generate a publicly desirable outcome. That's the power of the market. The tyranny of controls is individuals pursuing the public interest end up by catering only to private interests. And that's the tyranny of controls. And I'm a 19-year-old kid and I'm reading this and I'm like, whoa, you know, I got to study more of this. And so the next, my trajectory of my life is increasing curiosity about digging deeper and deeper and deeper to try to figure this out. So when I got out of college and my wife and I got married, I was working as a tennis pro, teaching tennis and making good money. And we had a nice little life there and everything. And I was, every time I had a break, I was reading economics, you know, stuff, because I wanted to learn more and more and more about it. So my decision about going to graduate school in economics was not really like a rational calculation as much as I have to go do this because I can't be happy unless I do this.
That's exactly,
it's been that way since. Yeah.
That is exactly what I said too. And it was when I read Gary Becker's Nobel Prize speech after I graduated college. That's funny. That's really similar. So
just on that, Scott, let me tell you something. When I got in undergrad school and I got into economics, again, note the timing. It's the late 1970s, early 1980s. So a lot is being talked about economics at the time because of Reagan, stuff like that. But that's not the primary focus. I got fascinated by the intellectual idea of what economics could explain everything.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, and what happened is if you know, there's books coming out at that time that are popular versions of trying to communicate this economic application of the world to everything. So there's a book by a French journalist named Henri Lepage, and it's called Tomorrow Capitalism. And in it, I got introduced to Gary Becker, to Jim Buchanan, to all these people that otherwise, you know, so not just the Austrians, but all these other people that were doing it. Gordon Tullock's book came out called The New World of Economics, which is all about economics applied to everything. That's a little funny point to that. There's a chapter on sex in that book.
Yeah.
And Tullock and McKenzie start the chapter by saying, if you're the typical college student, these are the first words you're reading of our text. It's like chapter 10 or something like that. It's like way in there, but it's just this application, relentless and persistent. And so I can understand what you're saying about with Becker, because it's this, again, this relentless and persistent pursuit of the economic way of thinking to all walks of life.
Yeah.
And that was all sort of happening at the time when I was in school. And so, you know, I was among the first generation of graduate students that we're learning the new classical macroeconomics and the you know, invariance proposition, because we were now finally micro was conquering over, you know, macro. And again, the world at that time, macro was taught before micro. Like, if you go back and look at the course assignments, right? You
would
have your course before you would have micro. And so that was totally flipped and turned around. It was just the whole time I was in undergraduate school and graduate school, I had this sense of, like, this amazing sea change in the world, right?
Yeah.
And then it was reinforced by this stuff on the outside
because
all this intellectual turmoil was going on about the economics, and it was sort of making the older economics now new, right? And then it was happening out in the world,
you know,
the Reagan Thatcher revolutions, but also at the same time, you know, the sort of fiscal reckoning in the Nordic states, the collapse of communism, all that kind of stuff, all was in that first decade of me really studying economics.
Wow. So were you thinking about, like, maybe trying to go to Chicago, or was it always going to be George Mason?
So I still to this day am a very devoted Austrian economist and very much influenced by that research program of Mises and Hayek and Kirzner.
Uh-huh.
And so when I was deciding on where to go to graduate school, and a major reason for that is actually goes back to the basketball story about the Soviets.
Uh-huh.
I became obsessed with the idea of the U.S. being better in basketball than the Soviet Union. And then it became the U.S. is better than the Soviet Union in everything, right? I mean, that's kind of what. And so I go to college.
Because they cheated? Was that the thing? The Soviets cheated?
Yeah.
Oh.
And so then when I start learning economics, and I'm reading about the socialist calculation debate, and I'm like, here's the reason why the Soviet Union and so I became obsessed with that, and so that would mean that I wanted to study, and, you know, with those kind of people,
right.
And so my main choices were NYU, Auburn, which was just starting a new program, and then George Mason, and the Institute for Humane Studies had just sent me a brochure about George Mason University.
Mm-hmm.
And so my wife and I made a pilgrimage to the East Village where her maid of honor was living. And we looked around New York, and we kind of decided we really didn't want to live there.
Who was there then? Who was there?
Israel Kirzner, Mario Rizzo, and Larry White.
Oh, okay. So Mises has passed away at this point.
Yeah, Mises passed away in 1973. Right. He passed away in 1973, he retires in 1969.
What's Hayek doing at this time? Has he won the Nobel Prize already?
He won the Nobel Prize in 1974.
Okay.
But he is now busy, you know, finishing up law, legislation, and liberty.
At Chicago?
No, he's in Europe. He's at 76. He's in Freiburg. At the time, the student, he's in Freiburg.
Okay.
And eventually he writes Law, Legislation, and Liberty, and then The Fatal Conceit. And those are his last works, right?
Uh-huh. Okay.
But he's very old, right? He's sort of retired out of things.
Yeah.
So I have these three schools.
Didn't like NYU. NYU didn't feel right.
And neither Rosemary and I felt like we wanted to go to the deep south.
Yeah.
And so we took a ride. We went to George Mason. George Mason's in Fairfax, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Fairfax, Virginia just looks like your typical suburban place or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a guy there named Don Lavoie, who was an expert on the socialist calculation debate. And so I was drawn to wanting to study with Don. So that's where I ended up by going. At the same time that I was making that decision, Buchanan and his crew were moving from Virginia Tech to George Mason.
At the year you're going there? Like that's
the
gonna
year
be
the year I'm finishing up college is the first year that they're moving there. And I got interested in their ideas because, again, I was reading a lot of stuff from the Foundation for Economic Education. Senholz made us read their stuff. And Tom DiLorenzo wrote an article on Jim Buchanan and what now we would call constitutional political economy. And I read it and I was really, oh man, like this is something I want to study too. And then I found out, oh, he's moving to George Mason. So we were like, that seals the deal. Let's go to George Mason.
He's not won the Nobel Prize yet, has he?
No,
is that 82?
No.
When does he win?
He wins in 86.
86.
And so I was a student of his in 84 to 86 before he won Nobel Prize. And I worked quite closely with him. I was in his class when in 84, everyone thought he was going to win and he didn't win. And so I got the Jim Buchanan, who's kind of, feisty about the sort of mainstream and all the stuff like that. So that sort of added to the flavor of my graduate education.
So you specialize in public choice and Austrian economics when you're there?
Yes.
Is there a field called Austrian economics when you're there?
So they created a field so that students could concentrate their studies on that. And it was a big debate among Austrians because is Austrian economics a field or is it a paradigm? These kind of questions. And so at Auburn, they never created the field.
That was just that was the paradigm.
Well, of people who adopted that, but then, other people did the other things. But you could say a similar thing about public choice, that public choice is a field, but it's also a paradigm because you can apply it to IO. You don't have to just apply it to, voting markets.
Was that more common back in the 80s for there to be some fluidity with as far as is it going to be neoclassical or like schools of thought? Was that more common? I haven't really felt like I've heard that in a long time.
So I think that schools of thought are a function of what is not being emphasized at the moment. So think about this way, sort of ideas that you and I both would find very interesting and exciting. Like Armin Alchin didn't have to invent the idea of property rights economics.
Yeah.
It's one of the oldest ideas in all of intellectual history. It goes all the way back to Aristotle's Critique of Plato and the difference between collective ownership and private ownership. But Alchin had to rediscover property rights economics because in the Samuelsonian synthesis, the institutional bedrock of exchange relations got dismissed. It was treated as given. And when it's treated as given, it can be forgotten because it gets so pushed back into the background. It doesn't. So what Alchin had to do was come up with the property rights school in order to do what, right? To challenge that, forgetting of this, the importance of property contract and consent to, and I think a similar thing with Austrian economics. So, in many ways, a simple way to think about Austrian economics is that it's a branch of neoclassical economics that was one of the founders of the subjective theory of value being widely adopted in economics and the marginalist revolution.
Yeah.
And what the Austrians stressed in that marginalist revolution, the choice on the margin, is that the individuals are making these decisions based on their subjective evaluations. That sounds just like any other neoclassical economist, right?
Yeah.
But sometimes, the Austrians thought that the neoclassical economists, let's say in equilibrium states, when you concentrate on equilibrium states, what happens in those equilibrium states? The subjective dovetails with the objective, right? So this is, again, like think of Marshall. Right. So you have the subjective demand curve, but the objective, supply curve. So in equilibrium, what's going to happen? The subjective and the objective meet. And so therefore, I can just focus on the objective. And the Austrians are like, no, because you have to explain the exchange process, which brings about the equilibrium outcome. And so the Austrian school rises up precisely because the neoclassical school is putting into the background things that the Austrians want to put in the foreground.
Yeah.
And so it's a battle, not so much between whether or not you think that there's universal laws of economics or that the way that you get at that is through the marginalist principles or whatever. So it's not denying the law of one price or anything like that. What it is, it's saying that what you think is in the background, we want to have in the foreground. What you think in the foreground, we want to put in the background. And so schools of thought, I think, arise entrepreneurial to try to shift that foreground background.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that matters for what I was talking to you before we started recording about the shift from theory to applied. Because when you go to the applied level, you oftentimes, you don't really, you blur those distinctions because that's not your focus of attention. Isn't on the theory. What am I putting in the theoretical foreground? What am I putting in the background? It's instead on how can I operationalize whatever I'm doing, right? To be able to, and that operization move, sort of, that, so that's why right now you don't really see schools of thought like you're talking about.
But
when I was educated, it was very common to think about different schools as different eyeglasses that you would put on. What Buchanan called seeing the world through different windows. You have to see it through this window or that window or whatever. And so what it meant to learn economics was to learn how to put on the different windows.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah. Huh. So that's fascinating. So you are at George Mason, but you're one of these Austrians that I've met where you also have dug really deep on Hayek and Mises, but also on Murray Rothbard. And you don't usually hear a lot about Murray Rothbard, but you know a lot about him, right?
Well, I studied his ideas a lot, and I met him several times while he was still alive, and he was a kind of a heroic figure to me as an undergraduate. I was mentioned before the curiosity of economics, but I also had this idea that the persistent and consistent application of the economic way of thinking did lead to some, examination of consequences for the broader worldview.
Yeah.
And my worldview was very much shaped by Murray Rothbard's Four New Liberty, which I still consider to be one of the best statements of the libertarian position out there. Mm. And so while I studied Man, Economy, and State, I valued greatly Four New Liberty, right? Mm. And so, going back to the study deep dive as a kid, trying to understand Mises was difficult at times, because it's he's teasing out arguments that are deep in the history of economic ideas, which I never, might not have appreciated at the time or whatnot, but I could read Man, Economy, and State and feel like I had, a good grounding of what was going on. And so even to this day, I Chris Coyne and I, how like when your kids come into Baylor, they have to do a math camp.
Yeah.
Yeah. So our kids do a math camp, but the kids that come to also want to study, with us, we make them go through like a seminar where we go through Man, Economy, and State with them.
So
they get the nuts and bolts of things.
Yeah.
Since that time, I would argue that I think Rothbard wasn't always right on everything or whatever, but I still think he's a very inspiring person that you can learn a lot from. And so if you look at his works, I think it's very valuable. He was an amazingly charming man.
Hmm.
When you met him, you called him Murray within 5 minutes. And that wasn't true of any other economist I had ever met up to that point. Hmm. And so he and all the bad things that go with that too. Like he liked to gossip, he liked to tell stories about people and things like that. It was a very chatty kind of way that you interacted with him, but he did that right from the beginning. He was very, very lovable man in that regard, and was very kind to young people coming up, even if he was sarcastic at times. Wow. So my friend Dave Perchico and I were just enamored to meet him, and he invited us to then stay and have dinner, with him, and we sat with him, had dinner, and we talked till way into the night with him and everything like that. He was a guy who stayed up very late at night and then slept during the day. So, we stayed up very late with him, hung out with him, talked to him. And at one point he said, he had this funny way of talking, sort of like the Penguin and the Batman things. But he goes to Dave and I, he goes, it used to be, I could never find a young Misesian. But now I guess I have to beat him off with a stick. He was talking about us, I think. And so, you know, he was someone who before I went to graduate school was very, very valuable to me in shaping the way I thought about the world.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
But then when I was in graduate school, I was taking Buchanan and Lavoie and Karen Vaughn and, Victor Vanberg, all these different people, Bob Tullison. I co-authored a paper with Bob Tullison in my first year of graduate school on tariffs and voluntary restraints, an empirical paper with him. And I sort of was learning economics. I had this great math econ teacher, micro general equilibrium teacher named Michael Alexiev, who after at Mason, he spent his career at University of Indiana. He was fantastic. I learned a ton from him. I mentioned DiLorenzo already. And then you'll appreciate this. Kevin Greer was my econometrics teacher.
Oh.
And Kevin Greer is probably the single best teacher I had technically. And that was because the way I would do it is it was a subject that I didn't really care that much about. Right? And he was so good that he made you want to learn the material. And yeah. I think that's probably defined Kevin's career throughout. He's just a very, very good at what he does.
Yeah.
I'm very fortunate I had him. So I was there from 84 to 88. Buchanan won in 86. And so it was a very magical time for all of us.
I bet.
And so then after that, I first taught at a school in Michigan.
Is he your advisor?
Buchanan?
Yeah.
No, but Lavoie was my advisor, but Buchanan would have been on my committee for sure.
When he wins the Nobel Prize, he kind of is,
but
like,
then he goes away from the university. So Victor Vanberg ends up by being on my committee. He was a close associate of Buchanan's at the time.
Well, so what you're doing, you're doing this work on the Soviet Union, right? It's kind of the political economy of the Soviet Union. Yeah. So, what's your approach that you're taking? Is it like a public choice kind of, what are you doing on that dissertation?
Synthesis between Austrian economics and public choice.
Oh.
To resolve debates. The way I approached it was there was this ongoing debate among historians about the first decade of the existence of the Soviet Union. Uh-huh. So like big hitters in history were, warring with each other. And my approach was, I'm going to take this political economy perspective and I'm going to resolve that debate. So I'm going to jump in, do economic history. So a combination of archival stuff, textual, I still to this day have my collected works of Lenin and all of that stuff. I read through all the different party congresses and everything. And I also did the sort of economic history of that. And then I sort of explain how those facts best are explained by this synthesis between the Austrian association with the problem of economic calculation, but then also the political idea of basically concentrating benefits and dispersing costs in the extreme form in politics. And so it was examining that. I tried to explain the devolution of the Soviet system from the high aspirations of the original Marxian dream to the reality of the Stalinist, controlled totalitarian system.
Mm.
And so in this regard, totalitarianism is a unintended, undesirable consequence of a dream aspiration which confronts a refractory reality, right? Mm-hmm. So you have this dream aspiration which can't be achieved, but then the outcome of that, the autopsy of that failure, is the totalitarian system that emerges.
Mm.
And so that's sort of the way that I make the argument work in the first book.
Yeah.
And the series of articles that are associated with that. I was very fortunate that I early on in my career, Alek Nov, who was the top economic historian of the Soviet Union at the time, read a paper of mine and decided to comment and get in a back and forth with me about that paper, which was great, because now I'm wrestling with the top person in the field, in my field, going back and forth. Mm-hmm. And it was on nuances rather than dismissal of the entire thing. Right. So I was very fortunate because, he could have found a way to take this young kid and like destroy him, because you know he was a superstar and everything, and he was the standard textbook of everyone. And I and he decided to do very well. And then when my second book came out, he actually wrote a really great review of it. So I was very fortunate, you know. But he was an old practitioner of economics at the time. But
yeah,
I benefited greatly from him, and also other older practitioners like Yannis Cornai were very generous. The people in the field were very generous people. Yeah.
Is it economic history or is it like the Soviet specialization?
At the time they you would do Sovietology. But there were historians in political science, in and history, and in economics. And so kind of articles that like, or the kind of stuff that Alec Nove would do is stuff that would be in the Journal of Economic History, but then his books and stuff. And a lot of it, of course, was, you know, examining alternative ways to do growth rates and, you know, that kind of stuff. What was the economic consequences of collectivization? You know, these kind of questions, right? On agricultural yields, on industrial output, you know. And so they would, you know, again, G. Warren Nutter, you know, had his book with NBER on the extent of industrial development in the Soviet Union, right? And so these things were all being debated. There was this opportunity in that field of Sovietology to be an economist and be an economic historian that was both a qualitative and quantitative economic historian. And so my work fell in that category. I was both, I was primarily a qualitative economic historian, narrative, but I also used basically a lot of data as descriptive data.
Yeah.
So I wasn't doing data analysis as much as I was doing utilizing data illustrate points.
Got it.
So tables and things like that. Yeah.
Did you, when you graduated and you go straight to NYU?
No, I taught for 2 years at Oakland University in Michigan.
Okay.
And I worked on, you know, these papers and things like that. I was offered a postdoc after my first year at NYU, but I didn't want to do a postdoc. I wanted to, you know, get on. My wife and I had our first kid, you know, we were, you know, and then I, in my second year, I got offered the job at NYU.
It must have been so exciting.
Yes, it was. I, when I came to the door of my, of our apartment in Michigan, I sang, you know, if I can make it there, I can make it anywhere. to my wife. And so I was, it was a real thrill.
How big was the job
market was a lot different back then than it is now. So, you know, it was, you know, the whole thing that you, of course, went through, which is the meetings at the AA meetings and then the flyouts and all of that stuff. But, you know, when I was coming out of graduate school in 1988, I had 3 days of the AA meetings. I had meetings from 8 o'clock to 5 o'clock interviews. So I was filled the whole time, right? And then I had, over 10 flyouts, and I had, you know, like multiple offers that all added up. And so I was weighing these offers. So I could have gone to a small liberal arts college in Texas. I could have gone to a small liberal arts college in New York State. I could have gone to a state, big, you know, middle-sized state university in Indiana. Another one in upstate New York, or Oakland University. And at the time, Oakland offered me, I was teaching in the business school, and they offered me the best salary and the best teaching, load. And what's interesting about that is that if you would have asked me 2 years earlier, let's say in 86, what was your ideal job? I'd say, I want to go teach in a small liberal arts college, teach a 4-4 load. You know, that's all I want to do. But once I got started working on my dissertation, I got really interested in research. So the idea that Oakland was going to give me a reduced teaching load, research funds, plus, you know, this thing. And the faculty, there's about 15 faculty members there. They were all very research active. They were more econometrician types than I am, obviously, but they were very supportive, and it was a wonderful environment to start my career. I owe those guys a lot because none of them tried to squash me or stop me from doing things. They encouraged me to do it. And then I had the opportunity to go to NYU, and that was like a dream come true. Yeah.
I bet. I mean, so when you go there, who are you looking to as like a potential mentor, or are you thinking that way? Are your mentors somewhere else?
Obviously Israel Kirzner and Mario Rizzo, faculty members there. I replaced Larry White. Basically Larry White moved on. He went to University of Georgia.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, basically the replacement of Larry at NYU.
Mm-hmm.
But I also, I should point this out, that there was two other economists on the faculty that I had been aware of their work and was very interested in learning from them. Mm. One of them was the department chairman that hired me. His name is Andy Schotter. And Andy Schotter had written a book developing a game theoretic approach to studying institutions.
Mm.
And I read that as a graduate student. Mm. And so I mentioned when I was an undergraduate, there was all this economic, universal application of economic logic, you know, sort of Beckerian program was all like while I was in the 70s and early 80s. Yeah. In the mid 80s, there was also all this interesting work being done on institutions, which had also been pushed to the background. Mm. And so now
there's like Doug North and Coase and stuff like that.
Right. So now, but they're the old guys. Now you have these young guys. So it's like, a kid today looking at Acemoglu. To me, those people, like, who were those people that were doing it that were the up-and-coming stars? And Andy Schotter was one of them. And
he's your department chair?
He was the department chair at NYU. So I was thrilled, you know, that to join a department that had Israel and Mario, who were my main thing, but also someone like Andy Schotter.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to learn, like, what Schotter was up to. He was also doing experimental economics, which was also kind of new and exciting to a lot of people at the time.
What year is this, Peter? What year is this?
I go to NYU in 1990, but when I was in graduate school, it was 84 to 88, and I'm learning about these people as the new thinking on institutions.
Yeah. Okay.
In like 85, 86, 87, you know, all that stuff is in the air.
Yeah.
So it's not just public choice and the Austrians, but it's also, you know, again, you know, Coasean economics, all these things are part of it. McCloskey, you know, writes her the rhetoric of economics, but pushing institutions and economic history.
Yeah.
And so the profession as a whole is going through this kind of change. Andy represented that. I was excited. And then there was another guy named Roman Friedman, and he had an AER article on the impossibility of dovetailing to a rational expectations equilibrium. And the argument in that paper was that we don't Bayesian update around a one true model of the world. We Bayesian update to what he called our theory consistent expectations. So a Keynesian will see the world and adapt the world to the Keynesian theory. And a monetarist will see the world and adapt it to that. And so what we get is Bayesian updating, but one that's very not smooth and easy. It's actually kind of jagged and you can have all kinds of things in that.
Huh.
And so the fact that Roman was there and Andy were there meant that as an Austrian, I could also try to, you know, reach out to these other people and try to learn from them to talk to the profession.
Yeah.
So, you know, by this time, I'm already, my whole thing is, which is very Buchanan oriented, which is that you have to steer this course between the arrogance of the eccentric and the comfort of the conformity. So you don't just do what everyone is doing, right? Just because that's what they do. But at the same time, you don't regale yourself in like, oh, I don't have to do what anyone else is doing because I'm so eccentric, right?
Yeah.
So Buchanan's whole point is what he called dare to be different. You had to dare to be different, but engage with the profession. So I'm trying as best as I can, failing all the time, to talk to mainstream economists and try to raise my hand in the economics profession to try to get across these points that I think they're underemphasizing about Austrian economics, about public choice, about institutions, all that stuff. And that's what's going on at the time. It's hard now for young people to realize that there was a time when formal theory actually said that their goal was to make the theory institutionally antiseptic, right? That was, if you read Francis Bator, right? That's his goal. My goal is to derive a theory that's institutionally antiseptic and trying to get institutions to come back in. Just like you mentioned, North, Post, Buchanan, you know, Alchin, Demsetz, all of these people, what made them different was that the profession at the time that they were making their contributions had put everything that they wanted to say as a contribution into the background. With Kirzner and Baumol, it was entrepreneurship. So Schumpeter, you know, Baumol, Kirzner, they're putting the entrepreneur back in, right? They're saying that you can't do Hamlet without the prince. So we better study the prince. We got to get the prince in there. But the prince is what, as you know, a theoretical nuisance to the model of perfectly competitive equilibrium, right? And so, you know, and so this is what was going on. And there was hope that it was all going to change in that regard, right? So, you know, especially when McCloskey's piece came out. Because part of McCloskey's piece was to say that the justificatory methodology that had dominated this approach that squeezed out these other things was now up for grabs, right? And that's in the JEL, right? So McCloskey's announcing that in the JEL. And so for a young person, you know, reading the modern literature and economics, we're like, all right, let's go. You know, we can do this. And then on top of that, that's 85. And then on top of that, my professor wins a Nobel Prize. It's like, all right, let's go. Like, you know, we're ready to go. And so, you know, you can't deny me, you know, kind of thing. And so that's a different kind of attitude than I know you mentioned. You talked to, you know, Peter and George. It's kind of a little different. They came from different perspectives.
Is there a little bit of some disappointment in the way this story goes? Because it sounds like you're saying I started off excited and it doesn't quite go the way I wanted.
No, I mean, I might be, you know, one of my sort of mentors outside of academics is a man named Richard Cornell. He was very important to me in my life. And one of the things he always used to say to me is he says, nothing is sadder than a young pessimist than an old optimist. And that was a Mark Twain quote. And so I still am very optimistic. I wake up every day excited to try to make economics more, you know, acceptable, my position of economics more acceptable to more and more people. Yeah. I try to work with, you know, the mainstream people that have, you know, sort of adopted some of these ideas. So if you look at like, the book, The Narrow Corridor by Acemoglu and Johnson, you'll see that, you know, I'm thanked in the beginning for the comments.
Oh, wow.
I'm reading Barry Weingast's manuscript right now on Adam Smith. I am friendly with Tim Besley, all these people that do political economy kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
And so I try to be engaged with all of them. Am I disappointed? Yeah, I'm disappointed because I would have thought that like our ideas would have been even more dominant. But at the same time, on my own grounds, I have failed. And going back to my sports thing, when you fail, what you do is you look in the mirror. You don't blame external circumstances. Mm. And so that's the way you get self-improvement. So all I can do is try to be better than what I was the last time.
Right.
And so I remain optimistic. I remain hopeful. I've had some really outstanding students.
Yeah,
that have done amazing work, and have had wider reach than even me. Pete Leeson, you know, was my PhD student. David Scarbeck was my PhD student. Uh-huh. You know, David's a now full professor at Brown. You know, Pete, we brought back to George Mason. I'm working right now with a young economist who I think is extremely talented young economist named Rosalino Candela. He was at Brown for a year and then he came back to Mason and I work with him. He's an outstanding microeconomist and property rights economist.
Mm.
Chris Coyne is another one who I think is just, you know, creating a whole field on defense and peace economics that he's working in that space. My other colleague, Virgil Storr, is developing this whole field on cultural economics and economic sociology. So I'm very hopeful that there are these, you know, people. I know you probably, so I'm sure you know Ben Powell.
Yeah.
Right. So Ben Powell runs this center at Texas Tech, mm-hmm. but you know, he himself has done this fundamental research on immigration. Mark, you know, it's just phenomenal. And, you know, Ben was my PhD student. I take great pride in everything that he's done there. His colleague, Adam Martin, you know, was a PhD student of mine as well. So I'm optimistic not because of my own efforts, which is what I was more optimistic about in 1988. I was like, it's going to be me that does it. It's now I see much more that it's these other people that when given the encouragement and the freedom, they can go far beyond whatever it is your imagination would have had. But I'm very hopeful. And it's not like I stop writing. I keep going at things. I keep taking bites of the apple, keep on trying to communicate the ideas. But yeah, so I love it, but it's, you know, I have, this is kind of the silly academic game we play, is that, I have, somewhere around a little over 15,000 citations. Mm-hmm. I look at someone like Acemoglu and they have over 200,000 citations. Yeah. Right. So when I do the comparison, I'm kind of like, you know, I want to be like more like Acemoglu than I am like myself. Yeah. But at the same time, if you would have asked me in 1988, when I got my PhD, are you ever going to have, 10,000 citations? I would say that would be a dream. I'd never have that. Right.
Yeah.
So I'm optimistic that it, I've had more success than I probably could have imagined, but I'm also frustrated because I wish I had the success. I wish I had 200 points better on my IQ so that I could be rivaling a research program like what Acemoglu's laid out for himself.
Right, right.
I have an aspiration. I have a reality. And, and I try to balance those things. I don't know if that makes any sense, but it does make sense. I love economics as a profession. Like, I love the debates that we can have and the discussions. I love working with graduate students that are excited to learn about economics. And so,
great. That's a breath of fresh air. I mean, honestly, Peter, that's just to hear your passion for all of it and for mentoring. I'm curious, this new thinking in Austrian economics article that you have with Chris Coyne, did you just kind of summarize a lot of those ideas when you went through and were like Peter and Virgil and everybody and Chris's
own? It's not just that, we picked the different buckets in which was going on. So that was a great opportunity. You know, Philip Agion's the editor of the Annual Review. It's a journal that was founded by Kenneth Arrow. Mm. It's a top 20 citation impact journal. So I hope a lot of people get to read this.
Yeah.
And, it's like the JEL in the sense that it was an opportunity that was presented to us. You know, we had to, explain what we were going to do. It had to go through a vetting process, all that stuff. So it's not like, just like a blog entry or whatever, but it was requested that we take a stab at doing this.
Yeah.
We did. We chose to focus on ideas in Austrian economics from 2000 forward, because a lot of times when people think they say Austrian economics, they think you're going to just write a history of thought piece on Menger or Mises or Hayek or something like that.
Yeah.
And we wanted to focus on the younger people that are doing work that is related to other work in the economics profession.
Yeah.
And so we chose to do these buckets, and those buckets are different areas of specialty, you know, monetary economics, price theoretic economics, institutional economics, and, law and economics and these kind of things. And then we sort of looked at the different literatures as they've added up, draw not only publications that are within the Austrian journals themselves, though we have a lot of those there so people can see, what's going on in the Review of Austrian Economics or the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics or this annual that comes out called Advances in Austrian Economics, but also to see where things are ending up in the JPE or the EJ or the APSR, because people work at this intersection within Austrian economics of economics, political economy, and social philosophy. And so there's different pockets. And so we were all like, people that were tackling, real world problems. So like Leeson, to give an example of Pete Leeson's work, there's been all this work on self-regulation. Like Lisa Bernstein talking about, you know, the diamond market, you know, in New York City, or Brock Richmond's book on the diamond merchants. Or I have this book on my shelf here called, We the Miners, which is about how you got governance institutions without a state among the miners in California during the 19th century, right?
Yeah.
Well, this is the kind of work that Leeson does. He examines and he studies how it is that you can, you know, it's trivial in some sense to get self-regulation in a world of homogeneous agents with small numbers with very low discount rates, okay? So one of the things that Leeson tries to do to stress self-regulation is to push on those assumptions. So rather than small groups, let's look at, you know, large group numbers. Rather than homogeneous agents, let's look at heterogeneous agents. Rather than those with low discount rates, how about high discount rates? So I'm going to look at pirates, right? And so what Leeson does is, by doing that, he then wants to study what are the mechanisms that actually serve the same purpose that a pure reputational mechanism would work in: small groups, homogeneous, and with low discount rates, right? And so Leeson is right in the middle of that literature with Abner Greif, you know, all those kind of studies of the evolution of institutions in the late medieval period and all that stuff. And as you know, he specializes on picking, you know, kind of strange topics and then explaining the functional significance of each of those institutions. So, you know, that he took that research program, which I had developed in very nascent terms in studying the Soviet black market. Because you can't have you can't have regulation due to the state in the black market, right? So you have to have these extra, you know, legal mechanisms that somehow come up to work, kinship, all kinds of things like that, right?
Yeah.
But like Leeson and Ed Stringham and other people and David Skarbek, they've taken that research program and pushed it in directions I never would have imagined. So this goes back to why I'm optimistic, is because you can start with something and then people build on it and make it something that's far beyond what you yourself ever could have imagined, you know, doing.
Yeah.
I just gave a talk to one of my former students' class the other day. He teaches at Wabash College, and he did his dissertation on the economics of prohibition. But focusing again on the governance structures that arose up, not necessarily the nature of the good, right? That people have studied that, you know, you get permutant potency go up. I mean, this is all right up your original work that you did on prohibitive activities, right? But Nick is working on that, but it's more on the governance side. So if I was to do my Soviet black market stuff and do a co-authored paper with a young Scott Cunningham, it would be basically what were the governance structures of the relationships with the prostitutes and, you know, all of that stuff, because they can't go to the cops and say, hey, this guy did this to me. You know, how is it that they rely on that? And sometimes it's ugly and sometimes it's actually peaceful. Right. And so you gotta look at all those things. So, you know, we talk about that kind of work. We talk about a lot of money, you know, Larry and George, you know, really did amazing work in that. Industrial organization and entrepreneurship. Peter Klein, you know, has been in that. And so that's all kind of discussed in this, is various different ideas, in the hope that the modal economists that would look at the annual review of economics will like look at it and say, ah, some of this stuff is interesting. Let me dig into it a little bit.
Yeah.
And then they have a faith, which is if they dig, then they'll find worthwhile. See, so That's the issue for the eternal optimism. I keep on thinking the reason why my ideas haven't had the traction that I would hope they would have is because I haven't been successful enough at getting people to want to dig into it. Because once I believe they dig into it, then they'll be, of course.
Right.
They'll get excited like I get excited.
That
might be the flawed assumption in the model there, but that's how it works.
Well, you know, Peter, one of the things I've always noticed about you, and you've heard me say this, is I don't think there is a lot of people in the profession I've seen that has taken the job of being a mentor to PhD students as seriously as you. I know you're humble, so you probably aren't super comfortable with me saying that, but I'm just kind of curious, you know, what is your philosophy, or what is your sense of duty, or however you would say it, towards your students or towards the students at George Mason? Because it's, I've really been moved by watching how much you fight for them and care about them.
I really appreciate you telling me that. I am modeling behavior of the people who were my mentors and professors, like Jim Buchanan, Don Lavoie. You know, I got to know Don. Don was an assistant professor when I came here to study with him. And I, you know, I got to know him very closely as a friend. He basically adopted me into his family, both my wife and I. His wife, Mary, is who held the baby shower for my first son when, you know, when we were pregnant with him. When Don unfortunately passed away at a young age, I was the one who gave the eulogy for him. Mary asked me to do that. But, you know, so I worked really closely with Don, and he was an unrelenting mentor in the way he tried to teach me how to write better, how to read better, and then also how to be a teacher of impact. And he was just great. And I think if you talk to any of the students who studied with Don and did their dissertations with him, they would have that reaction as well. But I also think Jim Buchanan is extremely important in this regard. I had Buchanan and Tulloch, okay? So I had three, like, superstar professors in graduate school. I mean, superstars at the professional level. Right. So Jim Buchanan's a Nobel Prize winner. Gordon Tulloch's a distinguished fellow of the American Economic Association. Kenneth Boulding is the second John Bates Clark medal winner after Samuelson. He was my professor. OK.
Wow.
So the issue with Boulding and Tulloch, who were just amazing, is that it didn't appear that you could ever be them, because it's just like as if somehow they came up with ideas because like a bolt of lightning hit them. And then they were like, ah, here's my insight into the world. And we used to kid around with about Tulloch, because he'd say, like, he was like a guy throwing darts at a donkey, you know, picture when you're a kid, you know, you're trying to pin the tail on a donkey, and he would hit the donkey's tail like, you know, 2 out of 10 times. But the other ones went flying out the window and hit people's tires and all things like that. But still, 2 out of 10 is better than I could ever come up with. Totally. Right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, Tulloch and Boulding were like these flashes of genius. Buchanan's great strength was to try to convince you that he was just an ordinary Joe who just worked hard. Now, obviously, he had a mental engine that was just churning, right? Yeah. But he was all about get up and, you know, be at the office at 6 o'clock, don't leave till 6 p.m., you know, you'll outcompete everyone. It was all a very big work ethic kind of person.
Yeah.
But one of the things that he really cared about was mentoring young students to become professional economists, which is so at odds with other people of that kind of rank. So he never, just to give you a sense of him, he never ended his class without asking a question. Never once. He always ended up giving us a question to think about. Tulloch never ended the class without a declaration. All right. It, you know, so he would always tell you, this is the way it is. Boom. Buchanan was, this is, I want you to think about this because this, I can't figure it out on my own. I need your input to this conversation. So yeah. I love Buchanan's classes, even though they were, but a lot of my classmates didn't like him because, you know, they wanted to have the definitive answer. And Buchanan, and I'm always reminded of a great Richard Feynman line where he says that never fear asking a question that can't be answered, but always fear an answer that can't be questioned. And so I think that's the scientific attitude. And it was in Buchanan that I learned that. And I'll give you one example because it's a good one for young public finance economists to think about. Buchanan came into class one day and he says, well, it is said that a fly that grew 9 times its size could no longer fly.
Mm-hmm.
What does that say about fiscal dimensionality? Right? So one of the students raised their hand and said, Professor Buchanan, I don't understand what you're asking. And he says to the student, he says, well, neither do I, otherwise I wouldn't ask the question. However, what he meant was that, and it is true, that if you took a fly, a normal house fly, and you could blow it up 9 times its size, architecturally, its wings couldn't carry its body weight and it would collapse. because there it's not a linear scalar, all right? Right. And so it breaks down. And so what Buchanan was trying to get us to think to is, how about when you take a state and you grow it 9 times its size, can it still function as a state? So if you look at the fiscal dimensionality of the United States over the 20th century, what was going on? Like, what was the GDP to government expenditures in, let's say, 1910? And what are we looking at in the mid-1980s? And what had grown? And can you still get the same kind of functioning government? And Buchanan's basic idea is, there must be some way in which you get increasing function, right? And then you reach a point and you get decline, right? Which is like the wings collapsing. And so to me, I think that was like, you know, just think about like the dissertations you could write about that and the avenues that you could take in doing that. And I think Buchanan just gave those ideas away freely to all the students. And, you know.
And that's how you sort of, you feel that same kind of give it away kind of thing to your students?
So when I was at NYU, I was an assistant professor. So I didn't chair any dissertations. I was on a lot of dissertation committees. But I didn't chair any dissertations. I chaired a lot of master's theses. At that time, they still had to do master's thesis and whatnot like that. So I did chair master's thesis, but I didn't chair any dissertations. But I was on a lot of committees. And I watched how people were mentors on those committees. And I saw the contrast between the way that Buchanan or Lavoie interacted with graduate students and the way that these professors that were very famous at NYU, I mean, not Rizzo and Kirzner, these are the other faculty members. At that time, NYU, you had to have 5 people on the committee. So I was a junior faculty member, so I got thrown on a ton of committees, right?
Yeah.
Including, you know, like, I mean, Ed Wolf was a quasi kind of technical Marxist on our faculty, and he was doing all this stuff in development economics.
Yeah.
You know, the rate of surplus and blah, blah, blah. I was on a ton of those committees, you know, that would do that, you know, because there would be students that came. This guy, Todaro, had money that brought students in to just study development economics. And by development economics, they meant this kind of work that was done at that time. And so I was on those committees. I was on committees with Schotter. I was on committees with Baumol, all these different people. But, and all of them are very, very talented, very skilled, thinkers and whatnot. But I saw the way they interacted, you know, with students. And it was different from what I had interacted. So when I had the opportunity to move back to George Mason, a decade after I was there, I never thought I'd go back to George Mason. Tyler Cowan convinced me to move back to George Mason. I had a good friends there, and Karen Vaughn and Dick Wagner and Walter Williams, and they really encouraged me to do this. And so I went back there and I started now. And Tyler, when he brought me back there, put me in charge of graduate student programs in a thing at the time called the James M. Buchanan Center. So I was a deputy director. He was a director. I was a deputy director. But I was running the graduate student programs. And so I decided, okay, well, I need to work with these students in a way that's similar to the way I was worked with, because that's how I was able to do what I did. Well, they can do it even better if I, you know, do that. And so that's where it comes from. And the relationships and intellectual benefits that I've, received in my interactions with being on a dissertation advisor, as well as being on dissertation committees, both here in the United States and overseas. I've had the great fortune to be dissertation directors for students at other universities outside That's the United wonderful. States. And
How many have you chaired? How many students?
So I think I haven't done a count lately, but I think it's around 40.
Wow, that's great.
And then, you know, obviously sitting on, you know, probably as many committees as that as well. So I'm really, you know, I'm very, very proud of a lot of my students. Ben, I mentioned Ben earlier. And the reason why I oftentimes point to Ben is because I use a sports analogy from baseball.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, if you're scouting young people in baseball, you refer to them as a 5-tool player, right? So they, you know, can hit, they can run, they can, you know, throw, blah, 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 all that stuff like that, right? So, are they a 5-tool player? I think in academics, we have 5 tools too. We're scientists that write to our peers. We're teachers that teach our students. We are, policy relevant scholars, right? We are public intellectuals, which is like a teacher, but for people outside of our classroom. So we, you know, we write op-eds, we do things like that. And then finally, we can be program builders or entrepreneurs, academic entrepreneurs. Very rarely is someone all five of those. Yeah. Right. Most people are either one or two of those, and you got to find them and you got to nurture that and do that. But rarely you come along somebody who's a five tool player. Ben Powell is one of those five tool players. Mm. And so he's really something special in that regard. And so I think the world of him because he has been an outstanding scholar. I mean, just look at his CV and his scholarship. You know, he's been a great teacher. Look at the students that he's worked with, right? He was a major influential policy person when he was in California and was working on housing policy in California. Mm. He has been a public intellectual that's had a TV show as well as like op-eds and all these newspapers around the world.
Yeah.
You know, he became famous because he wrote a book called Socialism Sucks. Yeah. You know, which is, you know, and, you know, he appeared on all kinds of TV shows for that. Yeah. And then he's this amazing entrepreneur. He's built this tremendous free market institute there with all these faculty and graduate students. So to me, Ben is great. And I have, out of those 40, I probably have around 10 that are in that same vein. And they have had tremendous impact spreading out. You know, from Dan Smith, who developed a program at Middle Tennessee State and is now developing his own, you know, PhD students and all stuff like that, to, you know, Scott Bullier, who's a dean. He was the youngest dean in America in a business school when he was at North Dakota. Now he's at University of Wyoming as the dean of their business school.
Oh, wow.
And so these people are all doing amazing things.
Wow. Wow. Well, I'm sure they probably would say that, you know, just like you were inspired by Bob Buchanan, I feel like the inputs that you make in these students is just so clear, even from a distance.
Let me just say one thing about that, because it's related to the profession. So I became, when I was at NYU, I became quite friendly with Andre Schleifer, who was at Harvard, also working on Russian things. So And Schleifer, you know, basically gave me one of my major pieces of advice that I filed away and put in my head, which is he made a comment about economics at the time. And he just said in his Russian accent, he says, "Why be boring?" He goes, "Why do people work on boring things? You shouldn't work on boring things." And so that's part of the reason about trying to, you know, push a lot of these students to not be boring. Like, don't just do the same thing as everyone else is doing. Do something unusual. I'm going to give you the freedom to do that. Go, you know, go do that.
Yeah.
And the other aspect of that is also this, you know, again, this Buchanan line that I heard as a graduate student, but then later on in reading his stuff, this dare to be different idea. Which is related to the why be boring. And so dare to be different. But the other thing that Buchanan really stressed, and Boulding also emphasized this, is there's no benefits to being mean and cruel.
Yeah.
And our profession, as you know, has a reputation for being mean and cruel.
Yeah.
Our seminar cultures and everything else, right, are all related to that. Mm-hmm. And I understand the importance, because remember, going back to the sports analogy, I understand the you know, peacocks wanting to spread their feathers sometimes. And that's our seminar culture in a lot of ways. We value quickness, we value all these different things. And, you know, we have a sense of superiority because we're more analytical than the other social sciences, right? And this kind of stuff like that. And I get it. I get that. And that's it's an interesting game. It's a challenging game to play, right?
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there really is no reason to be gratuitously a jerk to people.
Yeah.
And so to me, I've always thought of individuals as, you know, I want to live in a society where people, you know, treat me with dignity and respect. And so if I want that for myself, I better give that to other people and see them and support and encourage them on the same margins that they would support and encourage me. That doesn't mean I don't tell people when they're wrong or I think they're wrong.
Right.
It's that there's always a way to do that, which isn't like I'm going to smash you to smithereens. I mean, I've seen in that seminar culture, like I'm sure you have seen as well, I've seen instances where, you know, grown people are reduced to almost tears by the behavior of their peers that are just unrelenting and beating them into the ground. And I don't, you know, I don't really know why that is valuable at any point.
Yeah.
And I view that across the ideological divide.
Absolutely.
Right?
So it's everywhere.
So yep. It's not like just because I want, you know, people on my side of the fence.
No,
to be
totally.
Nicer.
No.
I think everyone should be treated nicer. And
yeah.
And I, you know, so I value that. And I've tried to live by that. I'm not sure that I have always succeeded in doing
sure.
that. That's like all of us have our issues, but that's it. And I don't think that is not something that is hard to do.
Right.
It's just something to commit yourself to doing.
Yeah.
Rather than allowing yourself to fall into the camps. And I think it's more important for us today as teachers and as exemplars to our students, especially our undergraduates, to behave that way precisely because the world is so divisive.
Yeah.
And we have to show people that you can have rational discourse on very hot button topics without it devolving into divisiveness.
Yeah.
That you can just literally rational people can agree to disagree about fundamental issues while holding on to their position. So I'm not arguing that you're positionless. You can still hold on to your position, but you don't have to be a jerk about it. Let me give you an example. There's this company in Britain. The kids take a gap year after high school.
Yeah.
And there's this company. It's called the John Locke Institute. And what happens is the kids in their gap year that are going to go to Oxford or Cambridge or LSE, they sometimes sign up with this company, and this company takes them. On basically they go on a tour of the world, basically, and they come to the United States and whatnot. And when they come to the United States, they go to Washington, D.C., and they talk to policy people in D.C. and everything like that. And for about the last 5 years, they've come to George Mason to talk to different people, you know, Tyler or Brian Kaplan or myself or whatever. So they always come and talk to me. The last time I did it, they had two kids in the group. Now that remember, they've been touring around together for, you know, about 3 weeks by this time. So they're there and they have these two kids. Let's call one kid, you know, Harry, and the other kid, you know, Sam. Right. So Harry is a devoted libertarian. Sam is a devoted socialist. OK, so what the kids tell me is that they've made their life a living hell. Because every night they get back to the dorm rooms, they fight with each other like cats and dogs, and no one can, you know, no one's happy or anything like that. They said, "Do you have any way that, you know, you could resolve this or whatever?" And I said to the kid, I said, "Harry, I said, when you go home tonight, what I want you to do is defend as best as you can Sam's position.
Yeah.
And Sam, I want you to go home and I want you to defend Harry's position."
Right.
Now, what's sad to me is that no one had recommended that to them. And they were doing this for 2 weeks or whatever already.
Yeah.
But the rest of that summer, right, they do this in the late spring, early summer. The rest of that summer, I got emails from the kids who were part of that group thanking me. Because now their rest of their trip was so wonderful. Because once Harry got to see the world through Sam's eyes and Sam got to see the world through Harry's eyes, they stopped screaming at each other and instead like made jokes to one another about the different things, like and could, you know, get along while disagreeing. And I think that we need more of that in our society, and we as professors have to model that.
That
and
sounds a lot like
we don't model it, we're in trouble.
That sounds a lot like what you said Buchanan taught you, where you would take these glasses off, and you're now talking about it. Yeah, you're talking about it even at a real deep level of doing it against things that you like of your opposing position, even doing it there for the sake of connecting with another person and seeing things from their point of view. It's
this
really
metaphor of the eyeglasses was something that goes all the way back to my undergraduate education, because I had a great teacher in religion and philosophy, the first class I had to take, in which we did a lot of Michael Polanyi.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've read him, but Polanyi has a book on science, faith, and society, in which he talks about Christian presuppositionalism.
Okay.
You know, as a way to approach our understanding of the natural world. So, you know, Adam Smith says that we need to have wonder, surprise, and then appreciation.
Oh, he says that?
This is in the lecture, Adam Smith, this is in the lecture on astronomy, right? So when we look out into the natural world, we first have wonder, then we explore it. But when we explore it, we get surprised by what the governing mechanics are. And then because we've now delved into the governing mechanics, we get to appreciate the governing mechanics.
Wonder,
surprise, and appreciation.
This is in which book?
The lectures on astronomy.
Is that it? That's not in Theory of Moral
Wealth
Sentiments.
Of Nations or the Theory of Moral Sentiments.
It's not in
the Wealth of Nations or Theory of Moral Sentiments. It's in his lectures on astronomy. It's you know, part of the collected works of Adam Smith. Anyway, so Adam Smith had this idea of wonder and, you know, like that. And so to me, I think a large part of what Polanyi is trying to get at is that Christian presuppositionalism, you put on those set of eyeglasses, it allows you to see the world differently than if you had different eyeglasses.
Yeah, sure.
And so his point was to try to put on the different glasses. Michael Polanyi was the head of the Department of Physical Chemistry at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute when Einstein was the head of theoretical physics in the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute. And so we're not talking about some guy who was just a philosopher. We're talking about a guy who's deeply scientific, deeply involved, yet nevertheless, he was able to, you know, explore these things. And I think that, anyway, I'm babbling a little bit, but that idea of seeing through the different set of eyeglasses, that metaphor has been with me since I was, you know, 19 years old. And I think it's a very powerful one. And what it does in economics is it says, you need to learn how to put on those eyeglasses, which means that you need to take seriously and study all of these different positions of economists so that you can kind of, and that's why I like history of economic thought.
Yeah.
It's because the history of those different positions.
Yeah.
It's not that I want to say I want to be stuck in the past or that the past was better than the present. That's not true.
Yeah.
What I want to say is that the evolution of modern economics didn't just start with the AER last year.
Right.
It's this ongoing tension-filled conversation that is beautiful to watch unfold in the scientific discourse.
Yeah.
And it's interaction between economists and the world.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like, you know, what's going on among economists and then the world confronting them with puzzles and problems and anomalies and tensions and dilemmas.
Yeah. That's great, Peter. Well, it has been such a pleasure to get to listen to your story and just how brilliant you are and all the thoughts that you've had about your life and these ideas. And also just, you know, probably if I had to guess, you know, that eyeglass metaphor probably is paying off in how you mentor and give them, you know, because all your students kind of go in their own direction and, you know, you're not just telling them there's a right way and a wrong way. You're sort of open-minded, it seems like.
Well, I think that you know, this goes back to coaching. And look at someone like Scott Drew right there. Basketball is a team game played by individuals. So just think about that. That's an interesting kind of concept, right? It's a team game, but played by individuals. And what a coach has to do is give each of those players the scope for their creativity and their freedom to take them where they want, but creativity within the discipline of the team.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's that kind of idea. That's how you end up, you know, Scott Drew's team that won the national championship was an amazing team to watch. This year, Connecticut's team was an amazing team to watch because you had NBA level athletes, but playing like a team, both on the offensive end and the defensive end, the way they moved in unison with one another, the way they would set screens and move and the ball and all this stuff like that. It's just beautiful to watch.
Mm.
And to me, but what's amazing about it is it's still the case that, you know, when Newton, who won the most valuable player this year, you know, he had to make a play. He had that freedom and creativity to go make a play.
Right.
If you go back and remember your Baylor team, you know, you had the one kid who could really shoot really well, the tall white kid. And then you also had these, you know, the great guards or whatever that could just make plays when they needed to make plays. But they also were in the whole concept of the team. And so to me, this is the analogy for us in academics is, you know, we train these kids. We teach them how to reason and think like an economist. We don't tell them what to think. We tell them, you know, how to think about tough issues, How do I go and do it? You know, it's like when I deal with transition issues, I always start out by saying simple economics is not simple minded. You know, we have to first start with we're going to have incentive compatible policy changes. That's one. Second, no magical thinking, right? We can't have magical thinking. Two, you have to have incentive compatible implementation strategies, right? So the political actors that are involved can't like sacrifice their political life to get the institutional changes. Otherwise, they're never going to do it. And so there has to be this rare mix where you have incentive compatibilities at both the implementation stage and the carrying out stage, right, of the idea. But within that, now go think creatively about how you're going to do that. I just said everything and nothing by saying that incentive story, right? All right, I gave you some kind of, you know, framework within which you can't have magical thinking. Yeah. But then the creativity and resourcefulness and innovativeness of the of thinking about how it is you would solve those problems, that all falls on the person to have that ability to go. And I think this is like, this is the key thing to why it is they've gone in all these different directions that you've seen, but yet there's something coherent. There's a family resemblance, but not, they're not identical.
Yeah. You've been their coach. You've been a good coach, you know, the kind of coach you're talking about. Well, it's been such a nice time to talk and get to know you a little bit better. And I hope that we can cross paths and get to hang out even again.
You're due to come back for another seminar at Mason. Yeah. So let's plan
that's
on
right.
It.
I'm coming this fall. That's right. All right, good. Well, we'll hang out when I see you.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Bye, Peter.
Thank you very much, Scott.